Welcome everyone to the Macro Hive week ahead. I'm joined again by Dominic. Dom, how are you?
Oh, very well, thank you, Ben. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I thought it was going to be a quieter week this week. There's barely anything on the docket. Then Trump and Co. decided that they wanted to appoint some new Fed people, or at least potentially look at them. Perhaps we start with that then. It looks like Mirren's going to take Kubler's place, at least up until January. I mean, what do you make of this?
I don't think it's going to change much. I mean, Steve Miron is coming with a strong mandate to be dovish, but he will be only one out of 12 voters. So whatever he decides to push for, if it is too far from the consensus, it just won't get through. And from his perspective, if he wants to maintain credibility, he's going to either have to make a very strong economic case for a much more dovish policy, or to move closer to the median FOMC voter. So to me, it's not a big deal, really.
And we also heard some news this week that Trump's team are in favor. They haven't announced it, obviously, but they're in favor of Waller potentially taking Powell's place next May. I mean, what do you make of that? There's before that we had Warsh and Hassett as sort of the front runners. Now Waller's sort of taken this weird race lead. I mean, what's your take?
To me, Waller is a better candidate, both in terms of competency and credibility. In terms of credibility, given how much attacks there has been on Fed independence from President Trump, any outsider who would get appointed as chair would come with a big credibility baggage. So that speaks for nominating an insider. And then, Waller actually has, in my view, he's a strong track record. For instance, when he argued that the Fed would be able to lower inflation without recession, it turned out he was right. I think he was also a bit lucky because he was helped by a surge in immigration. But he's been able to offer a view different from the consensus that is still backed by strong economic logic and by data. And I personally agree with his view on the impact of the tariff. I think we can disagree, on how much certainty the Fed needs. If they need more certainty, they have to wait longer. So there is a little bit of a trade-off there, because if they wait too long, there are downside risks to the economy. But in terms of thought leadership, Waller is also my preferred candidate. Obviously, no one is going to ask for my view on this.
And I mean, one thing I wanted to ask is obviously Mirren's actually only on the board, at least for now, until January. And still the odds on the online betting websites are still, they're not certain that Waller's going to take Powell's spot. They're basically just above a coin flip. Do you think that basically still leaves a route open for Trump to put someone in Mirren's spot that could actually be the Fed chair, i.e. could someone actually take Waller's front run at the Fed chair?
So basically, what Trump doesn't know at this stage is whether he will have another spot to fill, because by law, there cannot be more than seven governors. And by law, Chair Powell has the option to stay on as governor after his chair term expires in May. And he has so far absolutely refused to provide any hint on what his decision might be. And I suspect it's because he obviously wants to keep his option open, but he also wants to see who is going to replace Governor Kugler. and make his own opinion of whether, you know, the Fed is safe with such a person or not. In reality, there is a good chance that Trump will have only one slot to fill, so Governor Kugler. Up to January, it's Miron. In January, Trump gets another option to extend Miron for a full 14 years term, or to name someone new. I suspect it's going to depend on Miron's, you know, performance, Waller's performance, but above all, the performance of the US economy, because President Trump has a tendency to conflate economic outcome with, you know, policy makers' decisions. So perhaps, you know, who knows if inflation slows and employment miraculously picks up, maybe President Trump will feel better about the Fed and more inclined to confirm an insider as chair. Who knows?
Okay, so basically, still a lot of unknowns, and it's going to be tough to call. But next
Yeah.
week, we. Oh, go on.
Yeah, but I would think it won't make that much of a difference to the outcome, because even if President Trump gets two slots, it's 2 out of 12. And then those people who get appointed, do they really want to waste their credibility by pushing for irrational policies? I'm not sure. So I think this whole thing has been exaggerated by the market because there was so much media interest in this saga. That people have focused too much on these personal issues and not enough on the underlying economic issues.
No, I mean, I completely agree. Because I mean, imagine the scenario where Trump does get a sway on the board. That doesn't just impact, I mean, you can't just impact credibility for the short term. You'd impact credibility for the long term, which, as you say, you argue that if you think of the Fed as a business, then, their credibility is sort of the long term view on inflation. That's, if you lose control of that, then my God, they're sort of in an awful position.
100%.
And then if we go to what's coming up next week. We actually have some big data points. We've got CPI, PPI, retail sales. Sam's landing with consensus for CPI, and he's had a pretty good track record. I think he's in the top 5% of forecasters. So I won't ask you to try and beat his forecast and give me a number. But what would you be looking for in the details? Is there something that you're watching out for that will confirm, in your view, that the Fed are going to cut in September?
100%. So the Fed is not worried about this month's CPI or PC. It's worried about the unavoidable increase in prices that we're seeing. And by the way, judging at politicians' recent move, I suspect people are starting to see the impact of the tariff, but we'll see. What the Fed is worried about is whether this increase in price will turn into an increase, a lasting increase in inflation. They can't be sure, but they are looking at a few telltale signs. So one is the behavior of services and of the prices of goods that are not being tariffed. I mean, initially, when Trump came up with the tariffs, there was a bit of doom mongering with Fed speakers saying that even the price on non-tariff goods would increase. I mean, you know, there was a fairly negative bias. But actually, what we've seen is that the increase in prices have been limited to tariffed goods. Non-tariffed goods like used car, really important indicator, they've been deflating. So the thing to look for is whether we are seeing increases in services prices, actually service price Service price inflation is falling, it's slowing. So do we see a reversal of that trend? Do we see a contagion of inflation from tariff to non-tariff goods? These are the things to look for.
So in your eyes, it's actually less important if we get a beat and more important that we don't see contagion. Because if we saw contagion, then we're in a real sort of different ballpark to what the Fed have been anticipating and has sort of started to move their base case towards.
100%.
And so that's CPI. We also have PPI, obviously, is important. Now the one question we seem to be getting from clients continually when PPI comes up is, where's the tariff impact in PPI? I mean, could you just go through why there isn't a tariff impact in PPI?
So it's purely a question of definition. The BLS that publishes a PPI, by conventions that exclude taxes, and that's because they really want to capture costs generated by the private sector, not by government tax policies.
Perfect. I just thought it was worth addressing. It's such a common question. It's always good to get an expert's opinion. And now the last major data point we're going to get next week, retail sales. Sam's looking for an upside surprise there. His estimate would round to 0.6 on the advanced month-on-month release with consensus at 0.5 percentage point. Number one, I mean, what do you make of that? That seems pretty bullish on consumption, on US demand. And the second thing I wanted to ask is around US data in general. Obviously, last week we had a pretty weak NFP release, once you took into consideration the details, as we discussed last week. But when you look at data more generally and you use sort of the economic surprise indices that we get to see every single day, that's actually remained positive. How do you digest that as well? So first, what do you make of retail sales? And then second, what do you make of this positivity in the economic surprise indices?
So the retail sales, it's an important data point because the US economy is 70% consumption. And what the retail sales is basically an advance, more limited release than the full consumption data that we get at the end of the month. Sam's model has a really good track record, so I would certainly not doubt it. A few times where I have doubted it has been wrong. So model 3.0. But it's just a single data point. And the part of the release that I tend to focus more on is a control group that excludes energy and a few arcane things like construction, building construction material. It's the one that is used to build consumption estimates in the GDP data. And this one is lower. The consensus is at 30 basis points. So I would say Sam's probably right, but it's only one data print. And it's not necessarily, the headline is not necessarily a good indicator of consumption trend. I mean, my view on consumption is that it's going to remain depressed for a few quarters because, one, we have fewer consumers, at least slower growth in the number of consumers because of the clampdown on migrants. And two, what's going on, and it's something that Chair Powell was alluding to last week, consumption growth has been unsustainable after the pandemic. And since the end of last year, consumption has actually flatlined in real term. And in my view, this reflects consumer debt dynamic and the fact that consumers are more cautious in part because they are scared by all this policy volatility, tariff talk. So they want to keep leverage under control. And that's why they are cutting down on consumption. And I think this is going to last for quite some time. So in general, my view is that we're not going to see much real growth in consumption for the next few quarters.
Okay, so the takeaway there is, sure, Sam's model could be right on the advance release, so we could see an upside surprise, but in reality, You think the broader picture there is actually for more sluggish consumption than that beat would suggest. And sort of the last thing to tick off then is Fed speakers. We had Kashkari this
Maybe
week.
a word about the surprise index. It's
Oh yeah, I
my
forgot, please.
favorite topics. Basically, the problem with the surprise index is that it conflates two things: the deviation of data from trend and expectations. And expectations are adaptive. So I suspect the positive surprise index, and also there is a lot of stuff that gets thrown in there, not necessarily with the right weights. Like if you think of data, demand data, probably the most important one is full personal spending data at the end of the month, but you have a lot of stuff that gets thrown in and is not as important. And the other issue is that expectations are adaptive, so it could be that the index is still in positive territory because people's expectations were low to start with, and the weights do not reflect the economic importance of each data release.
Awesome. So basically, the data could be slowing. It could be broadly slowing,
So
but it's just people's expectations are actually perhaps even more bearish than that.
the bottom line, I think, is that the surprise index is more important if you are in the market and trying to figure out where the market is headed than if you have a longer term view as an economist. I mean, as I keep saying, economic time is slower than market time. So the surprise index is more, a market thingy.
It feels like you've got a book coming out based on that. But yeah, it'd be a good read. Fed speakers, we were talking before this about Kashkari, traditionally a bit more hawkish, it's come out a bit more dovish now. We have Schmidt next week. What are you looking for there?
I'd be very curious because so Kashkari surprised me by these very dovish comments this week. And so I'm wondering if Schmidt, who is also actually more hawkish than Kashkari, whether he is also going to turn. That will be a good indicator of where the committee is headed. Though, the Fed is very much follow the leader institution. So given how dovish Powell was, I don't see a lot organized opposition from regional Fed president against a cut in September. But still, it will
And
be interesting. Yeah.
what do you think would open the door to a 50? I mean, markets have fully priced a 25 practically. What do you think would open the door to a 50? Would it have to be one of the doves leading the way, or would it really have to be the data sort of start to turn over more drastically?
I think it would have to be a turnover in the data, especially the unemployment rate. So, like, if we have a 20 basis point increase in the unemployment rate at the next payroll, I would call for 50. Alternatively, we would need widespread signs that demand is really falling, a big miss in retail sales, also a change of narrative, because as the Fed keeps telling us, they don't look at single data points, they look at the totality of the data to form a narrative. So we would need a big event that would really change the narrative, because right now, the economy is slowing, but it's unclear whether we are headed toward recession. Some indicators, like the conference board leading indicator, for instance, it's hit its recession trigger last month. We also have the Richmond Fed recession indicator. It has a really silly name, the SOS indicator, but what it is basically an improved version of Sam's rule. Still far from its recession trigger, but it's been increasing steadily, and it's going to continue to increase because based on the last claims, continuing claims data. So it's kind of a, we have a slowdown, but we don't know how bad the slowdown is going to be. So if we had a big story, a big economic story that suddenly would raise the risk of recession, that would also push for a 50 basis
And
hike.
then, I mean, just to round off sort of more on your broader view, then if we were to fall into that camp, let's argue, well, let's just assume that the data supports a 50 basis point cut in September. Would you start to change your overall outlook on the Fed at all? Would you start to move to more cuts in 2026? You know, how would that change for you?
Okay, so the on, in 2026, I expect only one cut against the market, three, and it's because I think the administration is not going to look at the growth slowdown and do nothing. We have the midterms in November, so I expect the administration to actually provide a bit of fiscal stimulus. And so that will reduce the downside to growth, but add to the inflation upside. And so, a 50 basis point cut to make me change my view of 50 basis on 2026, a September 50 basis point cut would have to reflect really strong recession dynamics that could not be overturned or offset by a fiscal stimulus next year. So the sort of narrative would have to get very sinister in terms of growth prospect to make me change my view on 2026.
Okay, so basically, if we're to get to the stage where the Fed are cutting 50, then we're just in a completely different sort of arena, with a completely different narrative than, you know, what the market's actually been sort of moving towards.
Well, it's not just the 50 versus 25, it's more what drives the 50. And if it's just it's insurance, things are getting a little dicier than we thought, I'm not changing my view on 26. But say if there is, like if we see a big string of corporate bankruptcies, or we've just seen some issues with CRE, corporate real estate debt. Suddenly it becomes a big problem, and there are pervasive weaknesses across all banks, or something really unexpected and big that would change the growth trajectory. If this was a big change of that nature that would drive the 50, yeah, I would change my 2026 view.
Incredible. Well, thank you, Dominic. That's incredible. And thank you, everyone, for watching. We'll speak to
Thank
you
you,
next week.
Ben. I hope my stories are credible and will get validated by the facts eventually.
No, we'll come chasing after you if the Fed cut more than once next year. Otherwise, we'll let you off.
Good.
Well, thank you.